It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, artwork done by Wisconsin veterans to cope with post-traumatic stress disorder is on display at the state's Veterans Museum. We'll speak with the director about how that exhibit is helping veterans heal.
First, a legal challenge to the way Republican lawmakers drew legislative districts back in 2011 will be heading to trial. That was a unanimous decision by three federal judges yesterday.
Joining us now to talk about the details of the ruling and what it could mean moving forward is Milwaukee Journal Sentinel State Government reporter Patrick Marley. Patrick, thanks for joining us again.
Yeah, thanks, Veronica.
So what is the challenge here to the Wisconsin legislative maps?
A group of 12 Democrats sued last year, arguing that the maps Republicans drew were so favorable to the Republicans as to be unconstitutional, saying that they violate the voting rights of those who are inclined to vote for Democrats.
So what is the history of this challenge? Take us a little bit through the backstory here.
Yeah, so, I mean, the first thing to know is every 10 years, all states have to redraw their legislative districts to account for changes and shifts in population. And the party that controls state government has the ability to draw plans to their advantage. Both parties have taken advantage of this. In Wisconsin, most times in decades past when the lines have been drawn, there's been split control, so the courts tend to make the maps or some kind of compromise comes out. As it happened in 2010, it was a big year for Republicans, and they controlled all of state government. They were able to draw maps in 2011 that were very helpful to them in the state assembly and state senate. There was one legal challenge that resulted in some changes to two districts, and then, but otherwise the Republican maps were upheld. This is a second attempt by the opponents of Republicans to try to get maps that are not quite as bad for Democrats.
How did the Democrats in this case make their case that, as they see it, Republicans drew the maps to maximize their advantage and were successful at that?
So people around the country, both Democrats and Republicans, are trying to figure out what the best legal challenges to maps that have a partisan flavor to them. The U.S. Supreme Court, a majority of them, have agreed that maps can be so out of the whack for partisan reasons that they would violate the Constitution. However, a majority of the U.S. Supreme Court has not been able to agree on how you would measure that. And so different folks are trying at different times to come up with new ways to measure what goes too far when it comes to partisan gerrymandering. And so this is their latest attempt. They've come up with something that calculates the so-called wasted votes that are cast. Basically, if you pack a bunch of Democrats into a district and they get their representative to the assembly, maybe gets 80% of the vote, you've got all these votes that are quote-unquote wasted, because if those people had been in districts that are more competitive, it could have gone to defeat a Republican rather than toward a Democrat who is going to win overwhelmingly.
Is this the first time that a litmus test like the one you just described has been offered up when this question comes up?
I believe it's the first time that it's been presented, certainly the furthest that this idea has gone in court. This is a test that's been developed by some political scientists, and this is the first time that I know of that it's put in this kind of legal venue.
You were talking about how this is something that both parties have done in the past. They've redrawn the maps every 10 years to whoever's advantage, whichever party is in power. How is this different, at least as Democrats see it?
Well, a couple of things. Each 10 years, the technology develops tremendously in terms of your ability to draw lines. You go back far enough but you go back a couple of redistricting and people were using colored pencils and maps laid out on big tables to try to figure out where to do things. Now they've got, you can use something similar to MapQuest, and you can, take half of a block and put it in one district and half of another block and put it in another, and you can run these all through, software that tell you the voting habits in past elections, and you can really get results that are very beneficial to one party or the other. And as it happened in 2011, the Republicans controlled both the Senate Assembly and the governor's office. So they had opportunities available to them that we have not seen in Wisconsin in a very long time.
We're talking with...
Really, when you take into account technology, have never had before these kinds of opportunities.
Patrick Marley's with us now from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about a court decision that would allow a Wisconsin redistricting challenge to move to a trial. And Patrick, you say in your piece that the results of two elections show that the maps, this is a quote, the maps for the Wisconsin Assembly are more heavily skewed for one party than any other maps in the country going back more than 40 years. And that was noted in the decision. Why did the judges, do you think, make note of that?
Well, I think that they, you know, they've shown interest by allowing this to go to trial, and they haven't really tipped their hand of which party they're going to rule for, but they've seemed intrigued, at least, by the idea that the Democrats are presenting, and they took note of the fact that the model that the plaintiffs put together in this case was able to say that they could look back at four decades of races around the country and found that these maps, by this measure, were more heavily favored for one party than any other map in the country during those 40 years. And the State Department of Justice did not contest that, and I think the judges took note of that, that this evidence was produced, and the state is not denying that that is the case.
In terms of what this trial could look like, the shape of it, do you have any idea how this could unfold?
Well, it'll be a four-day trial, and it'll probably be really dry. You know, it will just be different experts on redistricting talking about why these maps were perhaps drawn the way they were, the kinds of information that they were using to calculate the likely partisan outcome, the fact that the Republican lawmakers, consultants that they used to draw these maps, had predicted what the results would be if they drew maps in this way, and the actual election results were very much in keeping with what they had projected.
What did Attorney General Brad Schimmel have to say about this?
Well, his assistant attorney generals are the ones arguing in court. He just put out a brief statement yesterday saying that he was disappointed that the court didn't simply rule in the state's favor based on the legal briefs, and that he ordered it to trial. The court ordered it to trial, but that he was confident that the state would ultimately win this.
And looking again at the people involved, what do we know about the judges?
We've got three. So redistricting cases are interesting in that they're heard by a panel of three federal judges. So it's one judge from the Seventh Circuit who was appointed by Ronald Reagan, and Judge Barbara Crabb, who represents, you know, is out of the court in Madison. She was appointed by Jimmy Carter, and then William Griesbach, who is from the Green Bay District. He was appointed by George W. Bush. So it's two Republican-appointed judges and one Democratic judge.
How important?
Judge appointed by a Democrat.
How important would you expect this decision to be as a precedent?
Well, it's hard to tell at this point. You know, if the court rules for the state and allows the current maps to remain in place, I don't know that that's much of a precedent. States would be able to continue to redistrict as they had. If the panel were to vote in favor of the Democrats, that would be significant because these maps would have to be redrawn, perhaps in very short order. It's a little unclear how fast this would all have to happen. And then it would go from there to the U.S. Supreme Court. You know, we're missing a member of the Supreme Court right now. Anthony Kennedy is very closely watched because he's sort of the justice who would determine these kinds of cases, because he's one who has said that he does think that the maps can be too partisan and violate the Constitution, but that he hasn't seen a method of measuring that yet. So everybody's really kind of catering to what they think Kennedy would ultimately like.
And Patrick, tell us again when the trial is scheduled.
May 24th it starts. It'll be a four-day trial.
Coming up soon. Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That was Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Patrick Marley talking about a recent court decision to allow a Wisconsin redistricting challenge to move to trial.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Farrack.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, it's Food Friday, and we'll talk to the woman who's being heralded as the keeper of America's cookbook tradition.
First, it's estimated that at least 20% of veterans returning home from wars in Iraq and Afghanistan suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder.
And while hospitals and researchers have been working on treatment methods to make PTSD less severe for veterans, there's no clear path to healing.
A program in Appleton aims to help Wisconsin veterans come to terms terms with her PTSD through art therapy.
That artwork and stories of soldier experiences have been curated into an art exhibit being showcased now at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum.
Michael Telsrow is the director of the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. He curated the War Raw exhibit that's on display at the museum now. He joins us to talk about that collection. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Well, how did this go from this program in Appleton to an exhibit at the Veterans Museum?
Well, Tim Mayer, who is the guy who runs Artists for the Humanities, approached me several years ago about a project that he thought would have some merit and that I might be interested in. And at first I was sort of unsure about it. He showed me some of the work. It wasn't terribly compelling, but he was pretty persistent. Mm-hmm. And then when I got to look at more of the work that these veterans had done, I just felt that we had to do it. It was one of those things that just we had to do.
And it seems like the story is, it's the art you're looking at, but also this is a case where it came from. The process that created the art is really important.
Really, it really is about the process, and it really is about the emotion and the feelings of these veterans. I mean, some of the work is very competent. We do have some very good artists in the exhibit, but a lot of it are just sort of average veterans who have sort of minimal artistic skills, but you will not be unmoved when you see their work.
Yeah, can you talk us through the exhibit a little bit?
Sure. Well, what you'll see in the exhibit are a number of works that are done on simple paper, simple printing paper. It can be done with crayons. It can be done with pencils. But you'll see what you'll see in this is their feelings, largely based on particular events that they've experienced, either in Iraq, Afghanistan, Vietnam is well represented as well, but also sort of these abstract feelings that they have. One piece shows television sets, and the subject, the narrator, talks about his feelings, these unstoppable feelings, these intrusive feelings that he has that he can't control, like televisions that are constantly on.
Well, I want to talk about some of the particular pieces of art, and we've got some of these pictures of them on the WPR.org website. One, you mentioned some are from the Vietnam-era veterans who participated. One titled, I Might As Well Go Back to Hell, and it's an anonymous Vietnam veteran showing a crowd on one side, heckling, I guess, a soldier who's standing kind of between hell, the war zone, and home.
Well, he really is between two worlds. You know, he left Vietnam, which was a real hell for him. He comes home and experiences something that is akin to that. It's not combat, but the emotional feelings that he receives when he comes back home, he feels that he might be better off back in Vietnam. So it really is illustrative of the Vietnam experience. Sometimes they feel as though they're in between two worlds.
Is this a common theme you saw from people coming back from other wars as well, this idea that they're not there anymore, but they're not quite here now?
It really is. It's that feeling of being not being able to reintegrate successfully. So they're sort of in between two worlds at that time. So that is a common theme. It does play out in Iraq and Afghanistan as well.
I want to talk about the audience before we get to some more of the artwork. I imagine a lot of the people coming to the Veterans Museum are veterans themselves.
You know, that is a substantial portion of our visitation, but you'd be surprised. The largest portion of our visitors are not veterans, and that makes sense because veterans are a small portion of the population and a shrinking portion of the population.
But I wonder how the veterans who come through react to seeing these artworks by their comrades, their fellow veterans here.
Yeah. You know, I have observed some veterans coming through, and really anyone who goes through that exhibit is moved. So we have had veterans groups come through with counselors, with fellow veterans to make sure that they have some support when they come through, because some of them are suffering from PTSD, some of those veterans who do visit to see the exhibit. I'm happy they come. I think it helps them, and it also lets them know that Artists for the Humanities are out there, and there are other things that can help them.
And you mentioned the majority of the audience, of course, are civilians, people who haven't experienced life in the military. What are you hoping they get out of seeing this, their understanding of veterans?
Well, most of us don't know anyone who has experienced combat. Mm-hmm. And since the veterans population is smaller and shrinking, it gives them an opportunity. It's a window into the veterans experience, really. And in particular, we hear a lot about PTSD. We're sort of bombarded with that on some occasion. But it really is a tangible way to see what they're going through. You know, these images are very powerful, and I think it's a wonderful way for non-veterans to see what veterans have experienced.
And it's the veterans telling the story in art form themselves. It's really not mediated.
Right, absolutely. It's uncensored. There's no middleman here. Mm-hmm. It's directly from the veteran.
We're talking to Michael Telsrow, director of the Wisconsin Veterans Museum, looking at the War Raw exhibit at the museum. It's art produced by veterans of Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan, and many of them dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder and other issues on their return to civilian life. I want to get back to some of the art that's on exhibit. A piece by an Army medic named Brian Duca Smith, and it's a painting called View of Al Ramadi, Iraq. Can you tell us about that one?
This is one of my favorite pieces in the exhibit. It's a large painting on canvas, and it depicts from a distance a burning Humvee. And this was a situation where Brian was unable to render assistance to some of his comrades who were inside that Humvee. They were pinned down in Ramadi. They were unable to render assistance. So he's watching this from a distance, and you have this this bird in the foreground here as well, symbolizing the view and being unable to get to his comrades. It's a very, very powerful piece, very large piece, and a very competent piece from an artistic standpoint as well.
And the distance that you're talking about, it's often it's a feeling of if I were closer, I could help, and I'm powerless from this distance.
Exactly. You can see it. You're close enough to see it, but you just can't render that aid. And it must have been absolutely gut-wrenching for Brian.
What was it like going through and curating? I imagine there were a lot of pieces that were created by this this program in Green Bay.
There were a lot. We went through maybe three rounds of selections. Christine Zicker, who was my assistant director at the time, who's now at the Chazen Museum, assisted as well. We looked for those images that were really accessible and readily readily available. Those things that kind of just jumped right out at you. We didn't select some. We had some criteria. We didn't select some that had language issues. We have a broad audience. We have school groups, so we had to leave some of those out. So we went through a couple rounds, and it was quite difficult. There were some that we wanted to include that we ended up not including because we felt that just in deference to the veteran, because some of the veterans were, you know, they weren't told originally when they did these works that they'd be exhibited at a museum. Now they all signed a release that they could be used. So we made some selections based upon content as well. Some of them were frankly just very, very difficult to look at, and we left some of those out.
And these veterans are from Appleton. I think I misspoke and said Green Bay a moment ago. Is this program, this art therapy program, being recreated in other communities?
You know, I think the expressive art therapy is not specific to Appleton and Wisconsin. That's done in many places. But Tim Mayer, who runs this program, has been really good about getting it around the state. He also goes to Toma, the VA hospital in Toma, and does work there. And so he's just been relentless with this program. He's put through, I think, over 2,000 veterans have participated in this particular program.
And you mentioned a wide range of artistic background among the people who participated. And the two examples I gave illustrated that. One, clearly a trained artist, the Brian Duca Smith, is clearly an artist himself. The other one is a person, maybe not a professional artist. How did you get that assortment, I guess, of more and less skilled artists?
Again, that came directly from Tim. Mm-hmm. Now, Brian and Todd Hartwig, who is the other accomplished artists who are featured in the exhibit, went through the program themselves. They were both dealing with PTSD issues. So we were fortunate. It was sort of just a luck of the draw that they had two artists who were competent.
And tell us a little more about what you're doing at the Veterans Museum. This exhibit's on for, I think, exactly one more month. Is that right?
It ends at the end of the month, April 26th, I believe it comes down. Okay. Our next exhibit is an exhibit called The Art of Persuasion, Mobilizing the Masses in World War I. And that's going to look at art as a propaganda tool, and also examine the role of the CPI, the Committee on Public Information, in shaping public opinion, getting support for the war. So, again, another art exhibit, but with a sort of a political angle as well.
A very timely 100-year anniversary of the U.S. entry into World War I coming up in not too long.
On the eve of the centennial in 2017. So we think it'll resonate well.
Well, leave us with a message about the War Raw exhibit. What will viewers take home from this, or what do you hope they take home from this?
Well, I think on a very basic level, I hope that they get a sense of what PTSD really is. You know, as I said earlier, we hear a lot about it. But I think in this exhibit, when you come and look at these images, they're very simple images. It strikes you very quickly. So I think that on a very basic level, I want them to get a sense of what these veterans are going through. And I want them also to understand that it's our obligation, our duty to take care of veterans. When we send people off to do one of the worst things that we can ask them to do, this country has an obligation to take care of its veterans. And so those are the two things I think I want them to come away with.
And briefly, the exhibit, as you say, wrapping up before the end of this month. Can you see doing something like this again down the road at the Veterans Museum?
Sure, absolutely. We are looking to broaden our audience, and I think these types of exhibits do that.
We'll leave it there, Michael. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Michael Telsrow. He's director of the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. He joined us on Central Time to talk about the War Raw exhibit at the museum, which showcases work from veterans participating in therapy, expressive art therapy to treat post-traumatic stress. You can see a sampling of that artwork, photos of it, on our website, WPR.org.
Coming up after the news, we'll dig into American culinary history with the woman who's dedicated her life to collecting and preserving American cookbooks. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk about the Wisconsin primary, a lawsuit against the State Department of Justice, and more in our Wisconsin News Roundup.
First, in an age where if you have a craving for a certain food, you can hop online and search for a local restaurant, or if you're feeling really gung-ho, you can search for a recipe to cook online.
But before the internet, cooks had only one resource, the cookbook.
Beyond their use in the kitchen, historical cookbooks are also time capsules of recipes long gone or food traditions that have fallen out of favor.
On this week's edition of Food Friday, our guest has spent decades preserving American culinary history through her lifelong passion of collecting cookbooks.
Jan Longoni is the adjunct curator of culinary history in special collections at the University of Michigan. Jan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, you are legendary, I think we could say, in terms of your ability to find and collect these interesting cookbooks. But how did you get started?
Yes, well, it's a long story. My mother said I was born reading a book, and I believe that that's correct. And when I was 5 years old, I wanted to get a library card so I could read more books, and I was not allowed to in Boston, where I grew up, because you had to be able to cross the street yourself. So I evidently threw a tantrum, and they gave me a library card. And now, I don't know if this story is true. That's my urban legend, okay? And I just started reading, but I didn't read cookbooks. I actually read everything else. And then when I was in graduate school, I'm jumping around now, okay? When I was in graduate school at Cornell, I was lucky enough to be involved with a Ford Foundation group who had brought Sputnik had just gone up, and Americans really were very nervous about going to the world. And they decided that Ford would give money to bring people from all over the world who might be future leaders in every country in the world. And they came to Cornell, and I worked with them, and we would get together every month or so, and people would cook something. And it was always fascinating to me to hear the Northern Indian people say, well, that's not how we make it, you know. And then when they came back to my little apartment, I would say, well, what would you like me to make? I don't know. You know, maybe you have strictures or something. And they said, typical American meal, I didn't know what that was. I grew up in Boston in a Jewish household, and so I went to the library at Cornell, which, of course, had everything, and I started to get into culinary history. And then very shortly after, my husband and I started traveling in Europe under Fulbrights or scholarships and things of that nature. Every place we went, we just decided to learn more about the culinary history. You know, they always wanted to know what to do with me. Well, it was my husband who was the one they wanted. And finally, I just learned a great deal. And so when we came back here to Ann Arbor, the university asked if we wouldn't like to give some classes on culinary history. And I thought, well, that's an interesting idea. Let me see what I can put together.
And you had a lot of cookbooks by that point because you had been, it sounds like, scouring bookstores, antiquarian sites in Europe to find cookbooks. What are some of the most remarkable early ones that you found?
Well, it was not only in America, but also we traveled all over, I mean, in Europe and in Turkey and in North Africa and stuff. But actually, what I should tell you is that, would you ask the question again, please?
Oh, sure. Tell us about some of the books that you found, because you started collecting them and you even started selling them. Which ones stick out to you?
Well, I should tell you that when I started buying cookbooks, scouting, having a wonderful time doing that, we spent all of our vacations looking at old books. We loved all sorts of old books. And I discovered I had been buying three copies of a book. And I thought, well, this is strange. Why am I buying three copies? And I say my mind had made up its mind for me to open a bookshop. I didn't know that until I suddenly looked and I thought, what are all these books doing here? And so I started an antiquarian bookshop called the Wine and Food Library. It's one really of the first few in America. In fact, I tell people, you'll forgive me for this, but that they tell me I'm the oldest living culinary antiquarian culinary book dealer in the world.
Wow.
And I don't know if that's true, and some days I think that's a compliment, and some days I wish they wouldn't say it. But so I've had so many books pass through my hands, and if you'll forgive me for jumping ahead and not quite answering your question, I have handled books from 1506 to books that are going to come tomorrow in the mail, okay? Everything between. And my husband, who is an emeritus professor of organic chemistry, shares the passion of studying food and wine and old books. And so we just have done nothing but that, really, for 61 years we've been married. And it's been a wonderful life for us. So we have seen all kinds of books. And you asked a question that is in my mind because I've just been asked, along with many other people, to choose the 10 most important, most interesting books I think need to be need to be made into a facsimile or shown for people. Someone is trying to do something called 1,000 books, and they've asked all sorts of people to give 10 books. Well, I have not been able to decide which 10 books
hard to pick.
I want to give them. But since I really was featuring, when I started all of this, I really was not interested in American cookbook history. I was very interested in French history, French gastronomy. But very soon, a man named Alan Davidson, who was a founder of modern culinary history, asked me if I would come to Oxford University in England and speak on the history of American cookbooks. And I remember saying, Alan, I don't know anything about American cookbooks. I'm not interested. Why don't you ask me to speak about French cookbooks? And he said, Jan, anyone can talk about French cookbooks, but not very many people can talk about American. So I want you to come and speak at Oxford at a symposium. So I said, I can't do it. I'm not prepared to do it, and I won't give a talk unless I'm prepared. So he said, okay, I'm going to give you 3 days, and I want you to decide who else could do it but you. By this time, I had had the bookshop for many years, and I had made many contacts. I mean, many every important chef in America, every winemaker, every cheesemaker, you know, they all were customers in my bookshop, which was such a lucky thing for me. It was wonderful. And I'm jumping around, but anyway, so I went,
I'm going to jump in for a second and let people know we're listening to Jan Longoni. She is known as America's foremost culinary historian, a collector of American cookbooks. And Jan, I want to get into some specific pieces of American history here. I understand among the books that you've collected at the University of Michigan now, the first known cookbook written by an African-American woman in the country. What is it like to discover, to get your hands on something like that?
Well, yes, that's one of my most favorite books, and I would be more than happy to talk about it. For many years, people thought the first African-American cookbook was written by a woman named Mrs. Fisher, and it was called What Mrs. Fisher Knows About Old Southern Cooking. Mrs. Fisher, we believe, was a slave, and after the Civil War, she moved with her family to California, and there she became, she started to cook and make things and work with the highest class of people in Oakland and San Francisco. And they asked her to write a cookbook, which, did I say that, was called What Mrs. Fisher Knows About Old Southern Cooking. And everyone thought that was the first black-authored cookbook by a woman. And one day I was in Boston. My mother was ill. And my husband called me up. He said, Jan, what do you know about a black-authored cookbook from Michigan from 1866? And I said, there is no such thing. We've seen it all these years. We've seen thousands and thousands and thousands of books. He said, well, someone just called and wanted you to tell her about it. So I said, well, why don't you tell her to send it to us, and we'll look and decide. I just can't believe that there's an 1866 cookbook written by a black American. So when I got back in town, we waited, and I said, we'd send the book. So we got the book, and we opened it up, and I took a look at it, and I thought, my God, this is 15 or more years before Mrs. Fisher, by a woman named Melinda, M-A-L-I-N-D-A, Melinda Russell. And Melinda was a free woman of color because her mother was a free woman of color because her grandmother was made free in Virginia. And Melinda was an unbelievable person. I say she's an indomitable spirit. And I also say what she is an African-American story and an American story. So anyway, so she started doing cooking in Tennessee where she was born. And then she worked in various parts of Tennessee, and then she owned a bakery, and during the Civil War, she was so pro-union that men in masks and guns came to her and said, you better get out of the South. So she was forced out of the South, and she lost all her money, everything. She lost everything. I forgot to say, she started to go to Liberia, back to Africa movement, and someone robbed her. She got married, her husband died young, and she had a child who was born, quote, handicapped. So they marched her out of Tennessee, and she heard that Michigan was the garden of the world, and she ended up in Paw Paw, Michigan.
Wow, what a story, and I know that's just one of the many that you've got there. We're talking right now with Jan Longoni. She's the adjunct curator of culinary history and special collections at the University of Michigan. We're talking with her for our Food Friday today and talking about how a passion for cookbooks turned into a lifelong journey to preserve American culinary history.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of older American cookbooks? Are these an important part of our history, maybe an important part of your family history? Do you have a treasured cookbook that's been handed down through the generations? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with Jan Longoni on this Food Friday. She's the adjunct curator of culinary history and special collections at the University of Michigan.
And she's a historical cookbook collector extraordinaire. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite classic cookbook or maybe a question about one. Do you have a cookbook that's been handed through the generations in your family? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take a call now for Jam. We've got Russ on the line in Monroe. Russ, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
I've been collecting cookbooks my whole life since I started getting interested in cooking. I'm currently a chef owner of a little restaurant my wife and I run, but I always like to say that I learned cooking because I was never formally trained through the cookbooks I collected, and then the television programs like Julia Child and all those going way back. But I've got love Jacques Pepin, and I've got a copy of his first edition of La Technique, which was a big book he produced that was had lots of black and white photos on how to debone a chicken and cut an onion. But it's really a great book. I also have, there's a guy from the 80s, the Frugal Gourmet, Jeff Smith, out of Washington State. Really great guy. I think he kind of died dishonored for something, I don't know. But his books were so spot on in the recipes, and they're always my favorite, and I still go back to them to this day. His one book, The Cuisine of the Three Great Dynasties, I think China, Rome, and Greece, has just some amazing, great recipes that, like I said, and I actually use some of the recipes in my restaurant today.
Oh, fabulous, Russ. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Someone who shares your passion there, Jan. Do you have any brief thoughts about the cookbooks that he mentioned there?
Yes, I do. I wish I could go to his restaurant. That would be very nice. So, but people really relate to the cookbooks, and they relate to the ones that belonged to their families that were handed down in the family. But they just really care about the books, and it's quite remarkable. And as I say, our archive at the university, which is called the Janice Bluestein Longoni Culinary Archive, that archive has, 40,000 books now that we have donated. And they go back to the 16th century, but of course there are many more modern ones than that, and they're from all cultures, but mostly American.
And Jan, you shared a recipe with us with some history behind it, the David Eyre pancake. We've got that up on the Central Time Facebook page. What's the story behind this pancake recipe?
Well, I think I first found it maybe in a book by, I'm sorry.
Well, that's okay, but a little of significance.
Times, New York Times food editor, and it's called David, I think it's called David Eyre. And it's one of these things that it takes 10 minutes to do, and it's delicious, and everybody likes it. But recently I was asked to send a recipe, Craig Claiborne. Recently I was asked to send a card with my favorite recipe to a great niece who's getting married in a few weeks. And I thought, what can I make? I don't know her too well, and it would be nice. So I'll send her the David Eyre, which I did. The David Eyre that I sent you the recipe for is a sweet one. You finish it off with butter and sugar. But my husband and I prefer savory things. So what we do is we use Parmesan instead of sugar.
Oh, that's a good way to go. Yes. And this is one of these big puffy sort of German-style Pannkuchen sorts of things, right? It's
exactly.
A puffy pancake.
Yes, and it's so easy to make. And all you need are two eggs. You can feed two people for a light lunch, and I recommend it highly. And the second one, do you want me to talk about that
one? Sure, yes, some Parmesan shortbread or something.
It's a Parmesan shortbread, and this comes from, I think, Bon Appetit or Food and Wine, I can't remember. And it's they're absolutely wonderful if you're having company over and you want something that you can cook in advance, bake in advance. And this simply is a shortbread, and you can put, this is with Parmesan, but we have had it with Parmesan, we've had it with rosemary, we've had it with blue cheese, you know, whatever you want, and everyone likes it. And I've never been to a wine tasting, and I go to many, that people have and said, can I have the recipe? Can I have the recipe? So that was why I gave you that as the second one.
And we've got both of those recipes. You can have that recipe at the Central Time Facebook page. I want to bring another caller on, Jan. We've got Jean on the line in Appleton. Jean, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
Virtually certain she must have a copy
of the Victory Cookbook, Wartime Edition.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
My favorite.
It has 816 pages and even tells you how to buy food. And at the end, there's a supplement on how to feed a family of five on $15 a week.
Jean, thanks. And I bet that's all, there's a lot of history there of wartime ration-ready cookbooks, Jan.
Yes. Just to tell you, yes, I know that book very well, but I can tell you we also have from the 1890s books called How to Feed a Family of Six on 15 cents a day.
Oh, boy. It's a different time.
Yeah, a different time.
So these cookbooks really are a window to the past. Do you feel like it is possible to know people really well and really fully through the food that they eat?
Yes, I think so. I think so. And I think... I think in America we have still have some kind of fear of food. I think not now. It's changed maybe in the last 15 years. And we were afraid to use butter. There's a book out to teach Italians, good ladies who were doing charity cookbooks said, my God, they're using olive oil. They better use butter instead. But we're not afraid of these things, and we're not afraid to try things. And I don't know about, I'm sure in your campuses, too, in Wisconsin, the students are getting so very interested. They're doing farm gardens. They're doing helping poor people with their food, feeding people. You know, it's just so exciting and interesting to me that all of this has happened. When I started the bookshop, which was, you know, 1972, I mean, there weren't a lot of people who were collecting cookbooks or who were really interested in the subject. And it took years and years and years before we could get academia to say, this is a subject worth studying. And there are famous chefs now who are teaching at Harvard University. And all over the country, they're talking about food. And part of it is because we're worried about agriculture. We're worried about... After the First World War, the American government discovered that so many people could not be accepted as soldiers because they were not in good health. They weren't eating right, they weren't exercising properly, etc. So that's when we started to really talk about food and what is food. And there's just so much happening, and it's a thrill to be involved in the food world. Let's put it that way.
Well, it's a wonderful story you've shared with us, Jan. Thank you so much for sharing these historical cookbooks with us today.
Thank you very much for asking me.
That's Jan Longoni. She's the adjunct curator of American Culinary History and Special Collections at the University of Michigan's Hatcher Library. She joins to talk about her work really preserving a big part of American history, culinary history, through cookbooks. And by the way, she shared a couple of her favorite recipes. We've got those the pancakes and the Parmesan shortbreads. You can find both of those at the Central Time Facebook page. Older recipes, but I'm sure they're still really good.
Right, I think I'm going to try that, David Iyer pancake.
Oh, yeah, me too.
It sounds delicious.
Sounds like and Finnish pancakes,
kind of. It's something cool thinking about it, a recipe from history, too.
Definitely. Eat a piece of history.
This is Central Time. In some ways, it's been a time of transition here at WPR. We welcomed two new producers to Central Time in the last couple of months. Halima Shah is one of them, and she's with us in studio. Hey, Halima.
Hi there.
If you call in, you'll be hearing her voice at the other end of the phone some days here on Central Time. And as she comes in, we're also saying goodbye today to Joy Cardine producer Christy Taylor.
Right. She's going on to a job as a producer at NPR Science Friday, which is super cool.
Also super cool, treats today, including Twinkies, which we discovered, Halima, you'd never eaten before.
I have never had a Twinkie before today.
And so we have to explain this. How can you get to a ripe old age, anyway, past the age of 10, and not have had a Twinkie?
I was never attracted to them. Frankly, when I look at a Twinkie, I just see an elongated, dried vanilla cupcake stuffed with whipped cream.
When does that get bad? So what did you think of it, though?
I wasn't that impressed. You know, I feel like people like Twinkies because of their nostalgic value.
They are nostalgic. I get that. And while we were talking about this in the hall, all these people crawled out of the woodwork. You're not alone. Lots of people have not had Twinkies, which I would not have believed possible.
All right. So you're not going to, you know, join the Twinkie of the Month Club tomorrow.
I'm not. And I mean, I grew up in the Chicago area, half an hour from where the world's first Twinkie was invented in 1930. And like, that's my relationship with Twinkies. It came into my consciousness when they shut down the Twinkie factory like 2 years ago.
Well, that was Halima Shah, one of the new producers here on Central Time.